Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It's brought to you by Chevron. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. If the elections taught us nothing else, it's that globalization has not benefited every American. And so in this week's episode, we're going to focus on some of the key policy decisions related to globalization and its impacts. I sat down to discuss this topic with Jeffrey Garten. Jeff Garten is Dean Emeritus at Yale School of Management, and he's also the author of From Silk to Silicon, The Story of Globalization Through 10 Extraordinary Lives. This event was recorded before a World Affairs audience in San Francisco. And now to my conversation with Jeffrey Garten.
Thank you. I get to introduce Jeffrey Garten, and I'm going to go off script, Jeffrey. And I had the pleasure of serving with him in government in the early 1990s. I'm dating us. And he was not only the smartest guy I worked with, but the nicest guy. Nobody has ever worked with Jeff Garten and not come away really deeply fond of him as well as admiring of him. So it's my chance to tell you that.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Garten served as Undersecretary of Commerce during the Clinton years. Before that, he had served in the Carter administration. And in between, I think you were 13 years on Wall Street with Lehman Brothers. Is that about right?
But you have to say, for this purpose, that I was also in the Nixon and Ford administrations. So my bipartisan credentials are.
And your tenacity is extraordinary. So we can blame you for decades of policy.
There we can.
Well, thanks for coming here to take responsibility. He's also written a number of books, all of which are great, but the most recent one is From Silk to Silicon. And it is a great history of globalization and something that he has been deeply involved in all his adult life, both as a policymaker and as a practitioner. And so this is a great opportunity for a conversation with you, Jeffrey. I probably should give away too that you're Ina Garten's husband.
Yes.
So everyone who likes good food will appreciate that Jeff's present to me in coming to San Francisco was her latest cookbook. I want to start with the elections. We can go back to history in a bit, but what was clear in these elections was that a whole swath of our society is experiencing a declining standard of living, that globalization hasn't served them well. If you were advising Mr. Trump right now on how to put together an inequality agenda or an agenda for addressing the needs of those voters, what would you recommend to him?
Well, I think the odds of his asking me are the same odds as my being in the National Basketball Association. But I think it's really a wonderful question because in some ways it's at the heart of everything that is happening. It had an awful lot to do with the election, and I think it also represents one of the biggest national policy problems, challenges. So I think it's fair to say that the starting point is that we have had several decades of really intense globalization. And that intensity has maybe best illustrated by the increases in trade and the import penetration. It wouldn't have been so dramatic had it not been for China's rise. And China's rise, together with its entering the World Trade Organization, which the U.S. was very supportive of, mm-hmm. created a surge of imports that was much greater than anything we anticipated. I mean, I can tell you, because I was part of that team, if anyone would have said that in 10 years China would be what it became, we would have laughed. And you know, we were surrounded by all the China experts in the country. Nobody foresaw what China would do, how much it would become the manufacturing center of the world. And those imports, they came in, and they came in a very concentrated way, and the impact was very concentrated. It's not to say that there wouldn't have been problems anyway, but we have, I'm going to say, 3 to 5 million people who were really badly, their lives, their communities were badly disrupted, and they really had no alternatives. And both Democratic and Republican administrations were really neglectful in not dealing with these people. I think that the election pinpointed the problem, but it didn't really have much to say about the solution. Mm-hmm. So if I were advising Mr. Trump, I would start by saying, your major program to reflate the economy, especially the part about infrastructure, and let's say the part about deregulating part of the banking system, that's not a bad start, but that is not the heart of the problem. The heart of the problem is that it's not only trade, but it's also technology that is taking jobs away. And the technology component in particular is going to be so powerful, it will dwarf anything that trade does, that we are sitting on a time bomb in terms of large swaths of the population that simply are not going to have work. And therefore, my advice would be, in addition to what you're talking about, we better have a reskilling program. It's mm-hmm. not enough just to create some jobs, because, you know, those infrastructure jobs are not necessarily sophisticated, and also they go away.
Yeah.
But we need to revamp our education and training system in such a way that people who are having trouble with employment are reskilled, not for the jobs that we see now, but for the jobs of the future. And that means a system of vocational schools that is far greater than anything we have conceived of. You know, it means incentivizing companies to have all kinds of apprenticeship programs. I think it means incentivizing states to experiment with all kinds of ways to train people for much more sophisticated jobs. I was saying to someone before, the metaphor really is not to build machine tools, but to learn how to program them. Mm-hmm. We won't be building those machine tools. You know, we won't be building a lot of the robots, but programming those robots, figuring out what they're going to do. So we're talking about, with all the technology that's beginning to emerge, training people for the jobs of the future, and we're not even close. And so I would say to him, if you're really serious about dealing with the constituency that was so vociferously enthusiastic about you, you're going to disappoint them unless you take this next step. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And will technology help in that education process? Because access, and as you think about our moving from a manufacturing economy to a knowledge economy, is, you know, basically the gap, the earnings gap between those with a college education, it just keeps growing.
Keeps growing.
Right? Keeps growing at an extraordinary pace. A lot of that's about access and cost. When it comes to vocational training, do you imagine a system that is a bricks and mortar system or is of education, or is this going to be more about courses that are online? Or give us a picture of what that new framework, educational framework, looks like.
Well, I think it's multi-layered. I think that the technological delivery is really important, and it's really important in terms of keeping people abreast of new skills that they're going to need. I think it's very important in the systems that we're going to have to develop for lifetime learning. Mm-hmm. You know, our educational system is geared to an industrial age, where you graduate, you know, in your 20s, and then you go to work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't think that is the system of the future. I think that we might be working and going to school all the time.
Yeah.
And we, you know, we're not equipped with that. I want to say that I don't want to pass myself off as an expert on this, but I think that our ability to deal with the future lies in having a system that creates many experiments. That is, I don't think anybody has the answer to this. And I think we should, what the federal government should do is it should incentivize the states and the cities. You know, the city, I mean, I keep talking about the states, but it's really the cities that have so much vitality. And they should be rewarded for coming up with new systems for training and delivery of this education. And if you ask me what should be the essence of our country over the next several decades, it should be massive experimentation. Because I just don't believe anybody has the actual answers right now. So creating that creating that kind of competition would be really great. And then we scale up what works.
So in the jobs that we can already see, we're already seeing the gig economy, which I think you note in your book that Uber didn't exist when you started writing the book.
Right.
So that's how quickly, either how long it takes to write a book or how quickly things have changed, or both.
Well, let's say this. Facebook just got started when I started writing that book. And even while I was writing it, on one day, two summers ago, August 27th, 2015, 1 billion people were on Facebook at the same time.
Extraordinary. So as you imagine, though, think about the jobs of the future, to what degree is it going to be what used to be called piecework? In other words, putting together more than one source of part-time employment in the on-demand economy. How do you think about the benefits, the sort of safety net that comes with a single employer, the pension plan, the health care coverage, et cetera? How should we be thinking about that as we look in the near future?
That's a great question. So you have a new kind of society, which is almost post-service economy. And you need a social system, a social framework that is not designed for the industrial age. I mean, our social security system, right? You get social security at 65. Originally, the calculation was you would not collect it for more than a couple of years because the life expectancy was you work your whole life, and you have 3 or 4, 5 years or whatever, and that's it. Obviously, that's not the case now. So I go back to this idea of experimentation. I think that there are a couple of ideas that I will throw out there, not my ideas, but I think they're symptomatic of what kind of things we have to think about. So one is some kind of a lifetime account that is available for education and retraining. You get it when you're born, and it comes to you in some way, you always have the means to go back to school. Now, we don't have anything like that, right? But you're going to have to think about this because your people's jobs, first of all, the nature of it's going to change so fast. They're all going to need all this retraining. And you say, well, this is really costly, but it's also very costly if somebody's not working. It's costly not only financially, but it's costly socially. So before people say, well, we can't afford that, they've got to compare the different situations. Another thing is, you know, a lifetime, a basic income. Now, you know, in Europe, they're already thinking about this seriously. There are referendums. I would like to see some of this stuff, experiments on a local level to see how it works. But I think our current structure, let's just set aside the medical side, because that's enormous in itself. But I think the current structure of the social safety net is nowhere near appropriate for what we're going to need. But in the meantime, we have to do more than, we have to have things like wage insurance, I think, which says if you go from one job to the other and the second job doesn't pay as much as the first for a transitional period of time, the government makes a part of that, which would encourage you to go to another job rather than go on unemployment. I think we need some way to facilitate movement around the country. You know, we see ourselves as a great mobile society. In fact, the mobility of workers is much less than it used to be. And this is a big problem we have in that there are jobs in, you know, certain pockets, but there aren't people. And people are not leaving. They're not moving the way they did. No one's quite sure why, but one reason certainly is that their houses are underwater. Mm-hmm. In the world that is emerging, we need people with enormous resilience, enormous mobility, enormous flexibility to get new education. And we're not close to that. And I would say to Mr. Trump, if you laid the groundwork for this, a lot of your sins will be forgiven. Well, at least some of them.
At least some of them. You started by talking about trade. And of course, one of the, I mean, it figured large, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, figured large in, on both the Republican and Democratic Party in the presidential race. In your view, is it a big loss that the TPP will not be ratified? We will be starting over.
Well, I think that, you know, I've always teased you about answering the subtext of a question. I think the subtext here is there is in the air the notion that we're not going to have more trade agreements. The first big one is the TPP, and there's one in Europe that is going right. to, seems to be stillborn. And, you know, how should we think about this? And my feeling is we need these trade agreements. We need them not so much to lower tariffs. We need them for the rules of how to conduct trade. And maybe the most obvious example is we need much better rules to protect intellectual property, especially at a time when so many other countries, one, are ripping off our technology, and second, are developing technology of their own. The big thing about the TPP was it had a whole bunch of rules. And these were rules, for the most part, that were very, that we proposed and we, yeah. in a sense, forced others to agree to. And as the world's biggest trader, these rules are really important to us. And without the TPP, it's like the rules go way down, and China is very likely to conclude a similar sort of agreement, only with rules that we would find ridiculous. And so this is a real loss. However, let's go back to where you started from. Where the big mistake was made was that we should have had a domestic package of policies to help people who were displaced right alongside the TPP. And when that went to Congress, we should have said, you don't have to worry that there is going to be another flood of imports. In fact, there wouldn't have been, but you could not convince anybody mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. because there's not another China. And I think we've already sustained the real brunt from China since their wage rates are going up. But the thing is, we didn't do that. And we handled the TPP just like we handled all those other agreements. And the government was deaf to the agony of all these people who had suffered partially from NAFTA, but mostly from China.
And the domestic agenda takes expenditures. And there may be recouping in the end, right, over
right.
time.
Right.
But it politics doesn't work that way.
No, and yeah. it wasn't on the domestic agenda in anything other than a token way.
Yeah.
And that was a really big mistake. And I think that the Obama administration should have seen this coming. I don't know they could have gotten it through a Republican Congress. That's mm-hmm. the problem. But at least they should have made that effort.
Right, right. Now, another aspect of globalization is the movement of people. And certainly immigration was a big issue, whether real or imagined. In the Brexit vote, surely the migrant crisis played a big role. If we go to Europe for a moment, what happened. Obviously, this is a shock, the extraordinary influx. But it's also an acceleration of something already happening, right? That Europe doesn't look the way Europe looked 30 years ago.
Right.
We're changing demographically as a country. Talk a little bit about sort of the ugly side of the politics and how globalization may be contributing to that ugly side.
Well, the word ugly is sadly very appropriate. I'd say this is one of the great tragedies of modern history. I'm on the Board of Overseers for the International Rescue Committee. Mm-hmm. So I see this through a certain lens. There are more displaced people today than any time since the end of the Second World War.
It's like 60 million or something.
It's over 60 million.
Yeah.
And there is no obvious way to accommodate this unless the war stop. In other words, there is no solution that involves just absorbing the people. First of all, they have to stop coming, and they have to be able to go back. You know, the UN Undersecretary for Refugees has said this many times. The global humanitarian system, this network of agencies and aid, it's totally broken. It, you know, it's not like they're trying very hard to catch up. It's broken. And so we are in a position of just having to cope the best that we can. For Europe, this is a much bigger problem than it is for us, although I think the case can be made. It should be a bigger problem for us because we should be taking more
yes,
of them.
Yeah.
But in the environment we're in, that seems to be a total non-starter. But for the Europeans, they have a problem that we wouldn't have to the same extent, and that is they have no assimilation mechanism.
Yes.
We've had our ups and downs in terms of numbers of immigrants, but I don't think anyone can say that we are not an assimilation machine. People disperse around the country. The schools seem to be equipped to taking them. The society is, you know, and I hope this doesn't change, but the society is very welcoming to people of different religions and different cultures and different, you know, national origins, which is not the same in Europe. So, you know, there isn't an answer to every problem. I think this is deeply serious, and it's getting worse and worse, not only because the people keep coming, but because the environment in the West is increasingly hostile to them. Yeah. And, you know, I worry that this is going to result in a lot more than just the anguish that we've seen, that it will create more of a nationalist backlash. It will result in much more crime. It will result in pressures on social systems that can't be accommodated. And I think it will result in you know, possibly terrorism, because it's going to radicalize a lot of people for different reasons. Those who are totally dispossessed and those who feel that these refugees are a fifth column.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what an answer is, but I tell you, you know, now that you bring it up, it is a real tragedy that this doesn't seem to be very high on the national agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Because kind of like those people who can't get jobs, you know, these human problems are, these are the open sores, you know, these are the ones where we have no answers.
Mm-hmm.
We have no answers at all. And we haven't placed them high enough so that the best people in the public sector, nonprofit sector, are totally preoccupied with them.
So the world or the United States that you describe of being this assimilation machine and being welcoming, that isn't what our politics look like this year. Do you think that what we were seeing in our politics sort of on the fringe of who we are? Is it a function of the way information was or non-information was spread? How do we get to the point that we sounded and acted like we weren't welcoming people. We were not an assimilation machine. We did not value the other.
Well, I think that some of this, let me put it this way. We have two kinds of issues here. One is the refugees coming across the southern border. Those are largely refugees escaping Central America and the, you know, indescribably horrible situation of the gangs and the wars. Mm-hmm. In my view, this wasn't handled very well. There was no due process, and we, as a country, have always taken these people in. Mm-hmm. So I think we should have. The second kind of issue has to do with the refugees from Middle East, from Syria, mm-hmm. Syria in particular. I think that we don't take very many. This is a problem. We could double the number. I think what happened is that it was a very nasty election, and both are flawed. You know, both were flawed. I think that Donald Trump saw this as a way to create enormous amount of tension that would favor his candidacy. And it was a campaign that was filled with hate and filled with divisiveness and puts us in a position right now with a great big question mark about what direction we're going to go in. And I think it is really, you didn't ask me to say this, but I will, because I know that this is a place for very, you know, straight talk. It is really a major question whether he can or even has the interest in healing some of the fractures that he caused. I'm sure we all hope he does, but if he doesn't, we are in for a long period, I think, in which we're going to look at ourselves and ask, is this the same country? So I'm very, very anxious about this. And I think that, because on the healing of these divisions depends everything else, mm-hmm. a consensus mm-hmm. on anything. Right now, I think we can't tell.
You know, as you think about it, and this is not just happening in the United States, is that there's a kind of a loss of faith in our systems of governance, sort of the sense that it's not looking out after us all. We're not all benefiting from the global economy. We're not all on top of mind when Congress passes a bill. A sense that those folks back in Washington are all about self-interest and not about the rest of us. I would be asking you this question no matter who won the election, how can the next president restore faith in our really unusual system of government, in which the public, private, citizen sector all have a role to play, restore a sense that we can get things done, that we're that practical, can-do society that we see ourselves as?
Well, such a big question. I think it has two parts anyway. Mm-hmm. One is we have to see some practical results from the government. And that means that it has to focus on one or two things and actually make it happen.
Yep.
I tell this story to some friends when I was in the Carter administration. For the beginning, I was on a White House staff. And President Carter said, here are our priorities. We're going to revamp the welfare system. We're going to revamp regulations. We're going to have a totally different energy system. And he went on, he said, you know, four other things. And Secretary Vance said, well, which of these is the priority? And Carter looked at him and he said, all of them. And none of it happened. So I think that President-elect Trump needs to focus on one or two things, and part of restoring faith is that the government can do it. So let's just say hypothetically it is a major infrastructure building program. It's tangible. I think that would go a long way. But the second thing that either candidate would have had to do is that they have to make it really clear that the hateful stuff that is going on is not American, and to be, I don't know how to put this strongly enough, visibly identified with demanding that it stop. And going to places where it's happening and actually putting their reputation on the line. There are more swastikas appearing on schools in the last week than it has been for years. This is, you know, this is just one thing. There are schools where the black children are being sent pictures of lynching. Who is you know, who is, this is what a president does, right? It demands that this stuff be stopped. And any hesitation, any feeling that somehow this is tolerated, I think that will undercut everything. So I'm not saying, let me put it a little bit more strongly. Either person would have had to get out front and make it a crusade that this stuff is not permissible, and to use our entire law enforcement system to make examples out of these hate crimes, because that's what they are, they're hate crimes. And if you let it go for a while in this environment which has been created, I'm afraid we will be looking at a country that is not the one that anybody in this room would want.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing my conversation with Jeffrey Garten. Jeff Garten is Dean Emeritus at the Yale School of Management, and he's also the author of a terrific new book entitled From Silk to Silicon, The Story of Globalization Through 10 Extraordinary Lives. The event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization, and you can visit us at worldaffairs.org. Now back to our conversation.
This is definitely not to excuse it, but are we less generous during times of economic stagnation? Is that part of the backdrop?
Well, if we were growing very, very fast, maybe, but the notion that somehow this country's in the dumps, that may have appeared in the election, but it's not true. I mean, we're growing faster than virtually anyone but India and China. We have an unemployment of under 5%. You know, for the last year, the median, for the first time, the medium wage has really gone up. So I think the level of growth may be important, but also the trajectory. And this trajectory is not so bad. I'm not saying it's great. I'm not saying it shouldn't be better. But no one knows how to make it better. So I think the basic premise that somehow it's a big economic downturn, that we're in a recession, you know, and that's what's causing it, that's not true.
So we served together in the 90s, which was a booming time, for which I held you entirely responsible.
Yeah,
was I right?
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. You were really good. So you know, we heard in this election year about the basket of horribles, and you wrote in your book From Silk to Silicon, as far as I'm concerned, it really was it is the basket of horribles. You start with Genghis Khan. Now tell me, how does Genghis Khan relate to globalization today?
Well, can I say one word about the book? So
yes. People will not be horrified that it's a book on Genghis Khan?
But also, I wanted to write a book about globalization, and there are so many books written about globalization. I wanted to take an unusual view. So I wrote about 10 people. And each chapter is the life and times of a person who did something so spectacular that they gave a gigantic boost to globalization. And that what they did not only changed their world, but it continues to change ours. And I picked people who were not just, who did not just have an idea, but who actually made the idea real, who rolled up their sleeves and did something. I mean, it couldn't have happened without them. They were both the conceiver and the executor and the implementer. So, and the people that I picked 10 from different countries and from different walks of life and over a 1,000-year period. And I think it's fair to say you read it with a different lens than I wrote it, which may be my fault, but it is part of the landscape that somebody who does something really far-reaching inevitably has a good side and a bad side. Genghis Khan, I picked Genghis Khan as the first person who united East and West, who created an empire from the Pacific Ocean all the way into Eastern Europe. Yes, he did it brutally, but when it was done, he created a transportation system, a communication system. It was the first time in history that somebody could go from Asia to Europe or Europe to Asia on the Silk Road safely and with no customs. Now, the reason he did it is because he wanted the plunder. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, he created this global system. And if you want to know what it has to do with today, just look at what China's doing. Their strategy is called the New Silk Road, mm-hmm. and they are with enormous force creating trade all through Eurasia, and in fact so much so that I have lots of quotes here from Deng Xiaoping and particularly the current president Xi talking about that he can hear the old caravans moving across, and that's what he wants to do. So this notion of the energy coming from the East and the new infrastructure for trade between East and West, it's right out of Genghis Khan's playbook.
So, well, let me just add to the basket of horribles included Prince Henry, and who, as far as I can remember, brought us slavery and colonization. But tell us your side of the story.
Well, the second person is Prince Henry, who lived in the 13 and 1400s. And he was a Portuguese prince. Portugal was poor. He was the third son. He was going nowhere. And so he decided to get in the shipping business. And he orchestrated the building of ships, the hiring of crews, the amassing of nautical technology from around the world, and he encouraged ships to go down the west coast of Africa, all the way, and they rounded the coast and were able to go to the Orient. But before Prince Henry, no navigators would go down the coast of Africa more than just a little bit. They were afraid that their skin would burn. They were afraid the winds would never allow them to come back because it was all wind, all sails. And he became the father of European exploration. It was those ships that circumnavigated the globe, that came to the New World. That's the good part, right? He made the world smaller and more interconnected. He laid the basis for everything that was going to happen afterwards. In the process, he also brought slaves back from Africa, and he was very instrumental in creating the slave trade, which, by the way, the theme of this book is that globalization is inevitable, that it actually started 60,000 years ago when families from Africa stood up and walked out for food, for security, for a better life. And we've been globalizing ever since. Mm-hmm. And so globalization has two sides. Just what we've been talking about before with trade and employment. And every one of these people shows that they happen to have done some major things, spectacular things. And I say that on balance, globalization is positive. But in their wake, some horrible things happened as well. But I wouldn't call them deplorables. I would say they were both, they have their good and their bad sides.
So in the book, you note that democracy has been on the rise. There is an extraordinary record of democracy spreading throughout the world. But you say it could also go the other way.
Right. I look ahead after these 10 people, and I think about today. And I am quite sure that globalization is going to slow. Not all globalization. I mean, let's put it this way. Trade is definitely slowing, and I think will continue to slow for a long time. International banking continue to slow. But technology transfer, data transmission, you know, McKinsey says that it has increased 45 times in the last 10 years. Travel, education, the spread of research and development around the world, all these things, there's no stopping them. It doesn't matter what President-elect Trump does, that stuff is going to continue. But I think on balance, the bloom is off globalization for quite a while now. I don't know the time period, I'm going to say 10, 20 years. And then it's going to come back because it's inevitable. And the link between these guys and that assertion is that a lot of globalization has nothing to do with governments. It has to do with individual initiative. And the 10 people that I talked about, whether it's Genghis Khan, you know, who united East and West, whether it's Prince Henry, who started global exploration, one of the people here is Mayor Rothschild, who created the biggest banking empire the world had ever seen. He did it from a ghetto in Frankfurt. One of the people was the person who built the transatlantic telegraph, which was the Victorian internet and far more significant in its time than the internet is in ours. All these people, they weren't governments. Yeah. They were people who figured out how to take advantage of the times. And here's the other thing. Virtually all of them lived in times that were worse than what we live in. That is, there were revolutions, there were wars, you know, there was backward movements of governments. They didn't have money. They didn't have the kind of money we did. They didn't have the kind of technology. They didn't have the kind of communication. So I'm not optimistic about the next several years. I think we're in for a really dark time. But the longer run in terms of globalization, I'm having done all this research, I'm really heartened. Because I think people in this room, you know, there's only one woman in this book. If I write this book in 50 years from now, well, one of you writes this book in 50 years from now, half of them will be women. You know, there are very few people here outside of the West and China. If you write this book 50 years from now, they're going to be people who live on the outskirts of São Paulo and people who come from the slums of Indonesia. You know, so we're sitting, I think, on a burst of global talent that the world has never seen. And if the next couple of years, if governments really mess things up, it won't be forever.
You also write about Jean Monnet, who basically helped give us the European system, or what ultimately became the EU. Just say a word about him but also what kinds of institutions do we need to manage this period going forward?
Well, Jean Monnet, right after the Second World War, you know, Europe was flat on its back, bombed out. And there was a big concern, it sounds weird now, that Germany, which was the most bombed out, was going to reemerge stronger than all the other countries. And the Europeans didn't know what to do about this because Germany had caused two major wars, and they were looking at a third. And they were also afraid that because there was so much damage and so much economic, so much poverty, that Europe would go communist. And here comes this guy named Jean Monnet, who was a cognac salesman, and he has an idea. He said, you know, we're going to have to integrate and put Germany in that integration. And let's start with just coal and steel. We'll take all the coal and steel of France and Germany, and we'll put it into an organization, and we'll give the organization sovereign powers. And that became the European Coal and Steel Community, and he became the first president. And in short order, the European Coal and Steel Community became the European Common Market, became the European Union, and then the Euro, and all from this one idea. Now, when I was writing this book, towards the end, Europe was falling apart. And so, you know, I picked these people who are, I'm asserting, who have done something that has changed the world forever. And I try to reconcile this, and I said to myself, and I believe this, that we may see the European Union, we may see its shape and size change very dramatically. It may be that it ends up just being a couple of countries, a couple of six or seven or eight, not the 26. But I'm absolutely convinced that the pooling of sovereignty, this will sound really weird now, is the only hope that we have over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. That you can't solve the global problems we face. You can't solve the refugees. You can't solve the environmental problem. And let's go back to the environment because this is so central. You can't do these things if every country tries to have its own way. For now, this notion of pooling sovereignty is dead in the water. It's not going to happen in my lifetime. But I think that in the next, towards the end of this century, we will see that come back in vogue. It doesn't mean you don't have nations. It just means that the intensity of the cooperation around different problems is far greater than it is today, and that it certainly, because I think it's going to deteriorate, than it will be 5 years from now. So you have to have a longer-term view. So I think Jean Monnet was ahead of his time, and what he did saved Europe. It saved democracy. It saved us from getting into another major war. And it's there are a lot of problems with it now, but I don't give it up.
So two of the questions we have from students relate to climate change.
Okay.
And I know you wanted to stay with the environment for a moment. That's what you meant, the physical environment or political environment. So this one asks how globalization affects climate change. Talk a bit about climate diplomacy and whether it can work kind of hand in hand with the process of globalization.
Well, I'd say globalization and climate change are two sides of the same coin. Yeah. Climate change is a global phenomenon. It can only be reduced if there is a massive amount of international cooperation. That cooperation, I think, took a huge step last year at the Paris conference.
Yeah.
It wasn't what everybody wanted, but it was the first time that we had a global agreement on environment. And it was followed very shortly afterwards by a global agreement to phase out all that stuff that comes from refrigerators. And so for a brief moment there, it really looked like we were onto something. If President-elect Trump means what he said in the election, that this is a hoax, and if he proceeds to, as he said he would, pull us out of the Paris Agreement and reverse all of the domestic policies that allow us to be in that agreement, all the for example, the mileage regulations on cars, the regulations that are phasing out coal. If he does that, there are some people who think that the agreement would go on without us. I don't think so. I think that, you know, for all the warts this country has, we have some great things. And I think that the climate, the Paris Agreement, was an example of something where we were very much in the forefront and where we cajoled a lot of countries to join, and because they joined, because we joined. And so in a way, this is a metaphor for a lot of other things, but I believe that the U.S. has to lead in the world, and we have to be really engaged. And if we pull out of that agreement, I think it will be a tragedy of first order. And I'm really, really hoping that this is an area where Donald Trump does an about-face. Because if he doesn't do it on this, I'm afraid he's not going to do it on some of the other things, which will also really undercut America's role in the world. And, you know, this is not some abstraction. We get stuff out of that role. It's not like we're doing it to be altruistic. We can't deal with the environmental problems unless China and India and other countries do. Otherwise, you know, it is so global, it'll just come down on us. So I think it's a really, really big issue.
So we have two other questions on climate. One asks whether green technology is a great investment and therefore good for the country. And the other one asks, from a career choice standpoint, is the great opportunity for one to, if you want to mitigate the problem, should you go into the public or private philanthropic sector?
Well, I'll take the second one first. I think that, does this have to do with climate or environment?
Yes. Well, environment.
It doesn't matter. I think there are enormous opportunities in all the sectors. You know, ultimately, what businesses do are going to be determinative of how much progress we make. So, if you're in business, you know, if you're in a corporation or you're an entrepreneur who is figuring out new kinds of investments in technologies, I think that's great. If you are in the public sector, gosh, the public sector needs all the skills that it can get. You know, if you are in the sector in between, and it's just so many opportunities. I always felt it doesn't matter what sector you're in, it's really what you love to do. And if you're really committed to this, there are going to be opportunities in all three. As for investment in green technology, you know, I would never give investment advice. I think the society really needs it. Mm-hmm. But like anything else, there are going to be opportunities to really succeed, and some people are going to lose their shirts.
You were dean, and you're dean emeritus now at the Yale School of Management. That's a business school. You would assume everyone would want to go into the private sector. Where are your students headed?
Well, a lot of them are headed to the nonprofit sector as well. Sadly, in my view, very few are going into the public sector. This is another big problem, which actually very rarely gets talked about in our country, and that is that, I mean, I've been in four administrations, and I must say some of the best, smartest, most interesting people are in the public sector. Sometimes, I remember once a student said to me, I'm not going to the public sector, all the people are stupid and lazy. And I said, have you ever been in the public sector? He said, no. I said, well, then you really ought to keep your mouth shut because you have no idea what you're talking about. But that being said, we don't have enough. These are the problems we're dealing with are incredibly complex. They require not only technical knowledge, but a lot of judgment and a lot of ability to see problems from the standpoint of different constituencies. I'm very partial to the public sector in Singapore, where ministers make over $1 million a year. Why? Because the government has decided that they're just as important as any business executive. And where the Singapore government goes into the high schools, not only the Singapore high schools, but the high schools in Vietnam, in Iran, in places where the U.S. would never go. And they say to these, the very best, they find the very best, and they say, if you spend 5 years in the Singapore public service, we will pay your way through college and any graduate school that you can get into for as long as you want to go. And so they're really out there looking for the best talent, I mean, the really best talent, and then they pay them so that, you know, there's no corruption, but beyond that, there are people who are not looking over their shoulder, how much money can I make, you know, if I go somewhere else. We're so far away from that system. Our country was conceived on the notion the government should be weak. That's why we have all the checks and balances. And in some ways, for a big country like this, that, you know, I'm not going to argue with the founders. But we need a minimal level of competence, and we need a minimal level of having really good people. And it pains me that the school that I'm in, which has students who would be so great in the public sector, they just don't go there. They're very interested in it, they study it, but they go either into business. But the good news is, awful lot of them go into the nonprofit sector. And if they're not, they find ways to be on the boards, you know, to be very active. Mm-hmm. So that's very positive.
So I can imagine listening to your stories from this book forever and ever. And so I really, if you want to know about Maggie Thatcher and John D. Rockefeller,
Deng Xiaoping,
who have I left out?
Andy Grove,
which is closer to our lives here. Jeffrey didn't come here to talk about his book. He came here to talk about globalization, but this book is the most wonderful background on globalization. And if you're not convinced that globalization is here to stay, just know that it started with Genghis Khan, so it probably will last beyond us. So please join me in thanking Jeffrey Garten.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured my conversation with Jeffrey Garten. Jeff Garten is the Dean Emeritus at the Yale School of Management, and he's the author of a new book entitled From Silk to Silicon. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Rob Spate. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.